The House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Frederick moves approval of the minutes from February 11, 2025. Are there any additions, changes, or corrections that need to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes from February 11, 2025 are approved. One housekeeping note on the agenda today, the line number three, the presentation from the Department of Children and Families, will be rescheduled for another time. There was a human error in the process for making sure that happened today. So we will get that corrected. And now we have a full hour and 45 minutes for the direct care and treatment presentation that we have today. So please save your questions and collect them. We'll get right into it. Just welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and start with your presentation.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dan Starkamp, Operation Director for Direct Care and Treatment, as well as the Incident Commander for the DCT Separation or Creation Project.
And Chair and members, for the record, my name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment.
And Mr. Chair and members, we're going to be doing this in kind of three segments, so it might be good to ask questions in between those segments. The first is an overview of direct care and treatment. The second is going to be talking about DCT creation. And the third aspect, we're going to ask Greg Peeling, our new Chief Business Technology Officer, in a minute to join us and talk about the EHR and technology changes that we're doing and answer questions.
Chair members, thank you for the opportunity to join you today to share a high-level overview of direct care and treatment and the important work we do. Direct care and treatment is a highly specialized behavioral health care system. DCT is the only behavioral health care system of its kind, scope, and size in Minnesota, so it occupies a unique place in the state's mental health continuum of care. We treat patients and clients that other healthcare providers cannot or will not serve because patients' conditions are clinically complex and the behaviors can be challenging. Some healthcare providers do not have the capacity or the facilities to treat these patients. Others do not have the clinical expertise or support staff. DCT facilities are not open to the general public. Admission is by referral only. Most referrals come from county social service agencies, the courts, community hospitals, and mental health care providers. With a few exceptions, our patients and clients have been civilly committed as one or more of the following: mentally ill and dangerous, chemically dependent, developmentally disabled, as a sexually dangerous person, or as a sexually psychopathic personality. As a healthcare system, DCT is similar in size to CentraCare, one of the state's larger healthcare systems. Each year, we serve about 12,000 patients and clients in our treatment facilities, residential group homes, and vocational sites. We have a statewide footprint when it comes to our facilities. As you can imagine, it takes a lot of highly trained clinicians and experienced direct care staff to deliver those services 24/7, 365. From a personnel standpoint, DCT is the largest department within a Department of Human Services. DCT has about 5,000 full and part-time staff. About 85% of our budget is for staffing, and our annual operating budget accounts for a very small percentage of the agency's overall budget. On this slide here, you can see that DCT has five major service lines: the mental health and substance abuse treatment services, forensic services, community-based services, and our outpatient services, which we like to call ambulatory services, which includes five special care dental clinics, as well as outpatient psychiatric and telehealth services. And the last one is the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, which is the nation's largest secure treatment program for civilly committed sex offenders. We also, within direct care and treatment, have five supporting divisions, which includes our operations support services, our behavioral health, which includes our executive medical director, our outpatient clinic operations, pharmacy services, and quality and compliance. We wanted to share with the chair and members some of the top pressures that direct care and treatment is facing right now. One is staffing. Recruiting and retaining staff is our top priority for the foreseeable future. The healthcare workforce shortage is a critical concern, and direct care and treatment is not unique in that challenge. While we've hired hundreds of new staff, we still have unfilled direct care positions. Staff are putting in a lot of overtime, and burnout is a real issue. We're placing an intense focus on recruitment and retention, but lack of staff can erode quality of care and lead to unsafe conditions for patients, clients, and staff. We continue to experience rising demand for our services. We are under constant pressure to admit more and treat more patients. This can be challenging based on the acuity of patients, as DCT is seeing greater numbers of patients with high aggression and volatility. Today we have limited treatment capacity, and the waiting list for admission to DCT facilities is substantial and continues to grow. We have taken steps with our existing facilities to expand capacity, but do not have additional buildings or space to add more. We've expanded our child adolescent behavioral health hospital in Wilmer from 8 to 16 patients. We've reopened the Ironwood unit at the Forensic Mental Health Program in St. Peter, allowing us to maximize the forensics capacity. And with the legislature's approval last session, we're in the process of closing the care program in St. Peter and repurposing the facility to add 16 more beds to the forensic mental health program. On the topic of discharge challenges, too many patients remain in our facilities long after they are ready to discharge because there are not enough step-down treatment options. The primary impediment for timely discharge is the lack of community-based treatment options, and we cannot admit new patients until these patients have appropriate placements elsewhere. We do want to highlight that counties have worked collaboratively with us to improve those who are waiting at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center from 40% to 28%. In highlighting the priority admission statute, at the legislature's instruction, we developed and implemented a new framework on July 1st of last year for addressing priority admissions. The new framework lays out several factors to consider when prioritizing people for admission from jails rather than only days waiting. Factors include medical acuity, accessibility to treatment, and impact to a referring facility. And the Priority Admissions Review Panel released a report on January 31st, and we are happy to share that, but there are some recommendations that have come out of that group.
Mr. Chair and members, before we get into kind of the DCT creation piece of this, I think I just want to kind of reiterate what Ms. Baronis was talking about here is DCT is a very specialized healthcare system in a government setting. That means we're regulated on both sides by healthcare organizations and several oversight groups, as well as we still follow all of state government processes as far as MMB, governor's office, and admin requirements in the process. So you can see why DCT is becoming our own separate agency. It's much different than Department of Human Services that really gives out the grants and does the policy side aspects. Really is the night and day difference between what we do and what VHS does. So having that focus, we've also got an executive board that we report to as opposed to a commissioner model, which was approved last year in the legislative session. And the whole concept there is we have healthcare professionals overseeing the hospital system that we've got. We've got eight different hospitals, 16-bed hospitals around the state that we manage, as well as major campuses for treatment in secure environments. We do want to offer to the committee tours, or Carrie and I'd be happy to meet with any one of you to talk about any more details about DCT in general. But why don't we open up for any questions about DCT overview?
All right, thank you for the first part of your presentation. Are there any questions for the directors? Not seeing anything at the moment. If you want to continue, and just please make sure that the microphones are close enough for everything to be picked up.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that reminder on that. That means everybody in the room understands direct care and treatment and all the details, correct? Again, if you've got questions, let us know. One of the key pieces for us is during the transition is really being prepared and being able to move to a new agency and being managed by a new executive board. This is new for a lot of people in the process, and I think we're putting a lot of time and effort in to make sure as we move forward that we are very successful. But I think everybody knows that as we move to something new, there are times when things just aren't going to come out right, and we'll have to work through those issues as we move forward. But we've got a very successful process so far that we're happy to share with you here. On the next slide, you'll see that today we are a separate agency by statute, but we still report to the Commissioner of DHS until July 1. On July 1, we move to reporting to the executive board, and the DHS commissioner, of course, takes over DHS in that process. That's a big day for us. That's going to be where we're going to be transitioning a lot of aspects over in the process. Next slide. Just a little background. DCT is a separate administration within DHS today. We have over 98% of our staff already in the budget for DCT. And even the 2% that we're talking about, which are support services of legal, HR, compliance, communications, and legislative, still most of the individuals were assigned to DCT that were reporting to DHS. We, over the last several months, have been transitioning those individuals under DCT's different supervisors. And as of today, we only got 6 people out of 5,000 that will be transitioning to a new supervisor. So it's the CEO, 2 executive directors, and then the 3 payroll staff. Everybody else we've already transitioned under DCT, paying for out of DCT budget. So that really makes it a little bit easier in the transition as we kind of move forward in the process. So what's changing? For DCT, we are going to have the same programs. All 5 divisions that Ms. Brunner has talked about here, we're going to have the same services. We are not changing what we're doing or how we're doing things. We are just transitioning to a new oversight body, being the executive board as opposed to the commissioner. And in doing so, we want to make sure that none of our operational components fall through the cracks during that time. So our real focus is here on the clients and making sure our clients and patients are cared for the same way June 30th as July 1 as we kind of move forward in the process. Next slide. What changes for our employees? As I mentioned, there's only 6 individuals that are going to be changing supervisors. But as far as where they're working and what they're doing, they're going to have the same work locations. They're going to have the same operational structure and same light leadership. We're going to still continue focusing on quality and safety as we kind of move forward. We got partners and stakeholders that we continue to work with, counties, tribes, as well as the other individuals and stakeholders that are out there in the process. Staff are not changing their jobs. They will have the same employment status, same job status, same unions, and same salaries and benefits. So because, again, we are so separated already within DHS, it's a much easier transition to becoming our own agency as we move forward in the process. Next slide. DCT creation really started 2 years ago when we started saying, okay, how do we start separating something so large as we kind of move forward? As I mentioned, the 5 programs, core programs in the area are not changing. What's really changing is how do we support all those different areas? We did this in 3 waves. The first wave was really looking at our core services. What is it that we're getting from DHS? I mentioned the legal compliance and all those areas, as well as what do we need to do to establish a board, what language needs to be changed, legislature. We had a bill coming here last year, and we'll have another one with a cleanup bill in the process there. Wave 2 is things that were ancillary with DHS and us. And wave 3 were all the other areas, so to make sure that we didn't miss anything in that process. We did this in 3 phases. Phase 1 was really looking at the planning aspect. We have 47 work groups. Those work groups had to come up with an action plan and have that approved and finalized by our logistics team. It's a team of individuals that meets twice a week to make sure that all the work groups are on moving forward. That was to have been done by July 1 of 24, this past year. We are now in the process of implementing all those action plans, and by July 1 of 25, we are going to transition from where we are to a board. But in doing so, we're not talking about major enhancements or major changes to the process. We just want to make sure that we get that transition made first. Then we're going to talk about optimization and continuous improvements after that piece of it. Next slide. Our original dashboard, and our dashboard actually is updated every Friday by our 2 project managers. This was our additional dashboard to say, when are we going to have the action plans finalized and approved? Again, the goal was by July 1 of 24. Matter of fact, we met this goal 6 weeks earlier in the middle of May. That you can see the dates when all of our areas were achieved. The black means that we've actually gone beyond that and have completed and are ready for the July 1 moving forward in the process. So on July 1 of 24, we said it's time to get another dashboard. We need to track how well we're doing and how we're moving through to become a separate agency for each of these work groups. You can tell that the darker the green, the further along it is, and of course with black means that's where it goes. So we're going from where we were in July to where we are today. Next slide. As you can see, there significant progress is made in all areas at this time, and we've got a third of our groups that are either ready to go July 1, waiting for that date, or they've already completed what they needed to have done in that time frame. The other groups, according to our project managers, are on track. We've got a couple that are in yellow, which are the fiscal and HR. We've been working really closely with M&B, because our goal is July 1 that everybody gets paid, that we don't get any reduction in, or somebody doesn't get a paycheck that following week just because of the transition. And I can tell you the intricacies behind making that happen are pretty significant. We're talking 5,000 staff that are being transitioned during the process to new department IDs as well as to new FINDEP numbers, our fiscal account numbers in the process, which are all being created. There are pretty much all set up. Now we've got to work with the M&B to actually get it into the system. There are ways that we've worked with them that we can actually get this in the system ahead of time so that it says effective July 1, it'll automatically transition over and it'll move from what funding bucket was to the new funding bucket in the process. So M&B feels that they're ready to go once we get this in place and have those identifiers in the system in the process. Very key as we kind of move forward. They also will take some time a month before to test to make sure that the process will take effect July 1. They also assured us that we can continue to operate and manage staff, and if they move our jobs or move around, that doesn't change what occurs in the process here. So operations will continue as normal, and behind the scenes, we'll just make sure that all of the individuals are transferred to DCT and that they get into the right buckets in the system in the process there. Next slide. Get a lot of questions about, so this is pretty major having another administration, another agency that's out there. And are we talking about a significant new footprint for government in the process? The money that we asked for last fiscal year, was $6.1 million. This was to fund 7 FTEs within DCT, as well as 3 FTEs in Minute. And any minute costs that are changing in the process as we kind of separate. That's the new money that was added just for creating our new agency in the process. We've actually redirected funding. Remember I talked about DHS, where we fund DHS for several of those ancillary programs and services, HR and so forth. We looked within that budget and we said, we're gonna be taking on aspects. We're not asking for new money, we're just reconstituting those funds into DCT employees instead of having DHS provide that. So we have 12 positions that we identified within existing budgets that are now focused on DCT. And again, it's in really those 5 key areas of support as we kind of move forward. So overall, we got 3 new Minute positions. We got 7 new DCT positions that were funded from the legislature. And then we redirected 12 new positions to support those areas that DHS was supporting prior to us. Before I get to the electronic health record, I'd like to acknowledge Greg Paling and have him come to the table if he wouldn't mind. Greg Paling is our new Chief Business Technology Officer for Minute. So they've actually, this is one of those 3 positions that we asked for funding last year. Mr. Paling has actually been with DHS and DCT for several years. He understands both organizations extremely well from the technical side, and he's really stepped up to provide some significant support to DCT. A couple of major things that Greg has provided us is, first of all, he has all DCT and Minute employees reporting to him now, where they're reporting to separate people before. He also had looked at DCT costs from Central Minute and helped separate that from DHS in the process. I'd really acknowledge Greg and his team for what they've done and continue to do. They are fundamental in our electronic health record, as we'll talk about in a little bit here. But before we proceed into describing that whole electronic health record, I'd love to answer any questions around the DCT creation, and Greg would be available for anything on the minute side that you may have questions about.
Thank you, Director Starkin. Questions for the Director, Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. First question, and I think you might have touched on it, but I want to make sure for the positions that were moved to your agency, of course, those no longer have to be done by DHS. Will their budget be going down by that amount? Is that a shift over, and you'll track that very closely to make sure that that goes down?
Director Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, that is correct, that the 5,000 employees will be shifting funding that, that were through the DHS umbrella, if you will now be under the DCT umbrella and will not be replicated on the DHS side.
Thank you.
Representative Gander.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll show my ignorance. Within your department, what forensic services do you provide? I understand that's kind of using scientific and data-driven approach to solving problems. How does that apply in your department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, that's a great question. I think the word forensic sometimes gets confused about, you know, CIS, and that's everything about forensics and where we're going. When we talk about forensics, we're talking about the patients that we're dealing with that are coming through the criminal justice system that are mentally ill, and dangerous that come to DCT in that process. So our whole facility down in St. Peter, or a big portion of that, is the forensics program, not necessarily the CIS review of that process.
Very good. One Senator final Gander. Question, if I may, Mr. Chair. And I think it's kind of all wrapped around in here. Maybe you'll get to it. What is the most significant benefit of this movement from within DHS to a freestanding agency? What, like, one, two, three things are we really hoping to accomplish, kind of the overarching objective? Thank you.
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, and all representatives, Direct Care and Treatment is a healthcare organization. So first and foremost is having a healthcare executive board that are healthcare professionals. The key piece is having doctors and nurses helping describe and decide what we do with patient and patient care in that process. We've also got individuals on there, our executive board, that have the operational experience and the fiscal experience to help support DCT as we move forward. So the biggest piece of this is we're being led by healthcare organization or individuals that really help drive DCT. Second piece of this is that board is staggered. So not the entire board goes off on one day or 1 year. There's a 3-year staggering period where 2 or 3 go off each year in that process. Under a commissioner model, the commissioner goes away and now you got a new commissioner coming in that doesn't have the history or the background in that process. And I'd say the third area is really around when you're operating a 24/7 operation, you really have to deal with a lot more of the logistics differently. I'll give you the example as the incident commander for COVID for 3 years. DHS was talking about masks and how we got to get them out to employees. Well, masks in the healthcare organization are really critical, and it took a while for them to understand that we need that. We are also, during COVID, described as a state government organization. So guess where state workers got on the vaccine status? Where hospitals got here and state workers got down here. Well, we're actually up here. And it took a while for us to get through the process. So I think by being acknowledged as a healthcare organization and with hospitals, we'll not only be able to focus better on their needs of our patients and clients, but we'll also be able to help government understand what organizations are dealing with outside of government in these type of areas.
Thank you very much. Gander. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for the director? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director. You know, some of my questions were answered by Representative Gander's question, but I sit on the Rare Disease Council. That's also an agency. We have a mission statement. What is your mission statement with this new agency?
Mr. Chair, Starkin.
Representative Murphy, our mission statement is really around patients and providing them the best care in the environment that is most suitable for our clients to be most behavioral. I know we've got a brand new statement that we'll have to get to the organization here, but it really is centered around our patient and providing the best care that we can for their patient.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's interesting because we talk a lot about bureaucratic planning. Basically, there's only 6 of the 5,000 people that even have a different supervisor. And so it looks like we've spent a lot of time planning, but I haven't heard too much about what we actually did that really benefits the end user and why we did all this stuff. And so a final question I have was really about how the appointed board was set up, because I know that in other agencies like rare disease, I know how that works, so I'm curious how it worked for this agency.
Director Stark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the legislature actually appointed 9 members to the board. 7 members are voting, 2 are non-voting. The Commissioner of DHS is one of the voting members in the process, and the governor... Mr. Chair, members, it sounds like somebody's birthday today, so happy birthday. Mr. Chair and members, the
board.
Talk about being stumped about on that one.
Talk about the board.
Mr. Chair and members, the board and the board direction. There are 6 members that are appointed by the governor. 1 member is a doctor or a psychiatrist or doctor in mental health. 2 members are either a hospital board or other board members with that experience, and 3 are on the operations of direct care and treatment activities, like facilities, a nurse, doctor, those type of things. So that's the 7 voting members. The 2 non-voting members, 1 is appointed by the counties. That is actually Lori Halverson, who is a commissioner for Dakota County, and the other is with the unions, and they appointed Lynn Butcher as their representative in the process. We've got 2 doctors, 1 nurse, 1 practitioner that's been there for a while, and we currently have 2 vacancies on the board. As new boards begin, people feel that they're qualified for the area, and they sometimes run into areas that don't quite match up to them being on the board. One person actually worked for the vets and the feds, and I think they had some issues on what they could actually be on and how that could happen. The other, there was a conflict of interest that we identified early, and they were given the option of either continuing with a contract or going off the board, and they chose to resign from the board. So we've got 2 members that are vacant right now and working with the governor's office. Hopefully they'll be appointed here in March. Again, the board does not take over officially until July 1, but we've got 6 meetings already planned, 1 in January and February that have occurred to give them a lot of background, 4 meetings at different sites so they get tours in addition to understanding DCT and the little things like civil commitment process for sex offenders or civil commitment for mental health in the process. There's a lot that they need to get up to speed on in that, and really hoping that the governor's office will appoint those 2 members in March so they get that experience before they take over July 1.
Representative Murphy.
Just 1 quick follow-up. Thank you for that. Appreciate the explanation. You know, so it is a government appointment that you get onto that agency now. With rare disease, we actually have members, 1 from the House on either side, on both sides, and 1 from the Senate. And it is nice to be able to communicate, to get to feel like you're involved in the process a little bit. And so that would be something that I think would be important to look at going forward for any of these. So anytime we start adding agency and agency and agency, and it looks like we do, there's like a lot of planning to make this all work, and most of what I heard was about planning. So, but with those board appointments, I think that could be done better, but I appreciate the explanation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Doerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Director Stockham, and for the presentation. You know, it took us a long time just to separate DHS and DCT, and I'm glad that we took that initiative, because DCT is our only safety net hospital. And we were running it as a Department of Human Services, which you end up seeing the conflict. You cannot be supervised by the entity that is paying for those services. So I'm glad that we did. And since we took over that process last year, we also instituted the board. It was through legislative process. Through the dialogue and conversation, we came up with the number and who should be sitting there, but also we create an advisory board within that process so we can have legislators who are going to be sitting advising the executive board. That will kick off in 2026 January, once the board takes on effective July 1. And I think some of the challenges that we've had, we're talking about the patients, and it's more about cut in, cut out. We don't make those decisions. I know there's a lot of challenges when it comes to our counties. There are people who are now lingering in jails trying to find those beds. We're being challenged by the number of people who should be, you know, be served by DCT, including children. I think you'll be hearing soon enough from Representative Hicks, who's going to be talking about those kids who need to have a place, and we don't have that in place. And also, when you look at the electronic health record, it used to be manual process. I'm glad that we invested that resources in the last session. Right now, we are up to par with regular hospitals, that the system you can share medical records, electronic health records, with the other hospitals, because we're talking about a patient who needs that service. And I think there's more to do with this whole process, but I just wanted to know, with the board now in place that have been appointed and they're hitting the ground, are they going to be able to buy into the budget, whatever outcome that we may get? Are they involved in that decision-making process at this point? Just to know as an overview.
Director Stark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Noor, the board will have a full understanding of the electronic health record. It is the fundamental piece for any healthcare organization. It's everything we track about our patients. It talks about medications. It talks about all aspects of their lives. And that is so fundamental to what we're doing. The board will be integral in understanding what the electronic health record is in those pieces. If I may kind of talk about the advisory board for a second. This body did put in an advisory board, two House members, two Senate members, one from each party in the process. Moving forward, we've got Representative Vertige, as well as Representative Baker, a part of it from the House. We've got Senator Hoffman and Senator Utke, who have been assigned to that. That board doesn't, or the advisory committee to the board doesn't take effect till January 1 of 26, but they may get may come on sooner to do the same thing we're doing with the board, bring them up to speed what DCT is, get them the background pieces as we move forward in that process.
Thank you. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have an open invitation to go see on-site. Hopefully, Mr. Chair, we can consider going there to have a little bit of a field trip so we can learn the work that they do and actually see what's happening in direct care and treatment. That, I think, will help a lot of folks to really grasp and understand the complexity and the, because we haven't even talked about the nursing home, which has got 90 people, it's full to capacity. Anybody coming from the Department of Corrections are sent to DCT for the nursing homes. You know, I think sometimes we need to look into who's coming in and where they're coming from. And it's good to go see and appreciate the work that DCT is doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. And my question is for Director Starkamp. Thanks for being here. 12,000 folks right now are committed patients. And did you say you have 5,000 employees or closer to 7,000 total employees?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, and all representatives, the direct care and treatment is 5,000 of the DHS's 7,000 employees. So we're going to be a large chunk that is just DCT. The 12,000 individuals that we have are all the individuals that are being provided services. So it's not just those that are in our programs, be it DD for our community-based services, or be it SPP and SDP commitments for sex offenders. We got mental ill and mental ill dangerous for Anoka and St. Peter, as well as we've got our chemical addiction and mentally ill in our outstate hospitals in the process. So the 12,000 also includes all of the wraparound services that we've got. So that includes people providing homes and support for individuals that are low functioning in the community. It also includes dental services, and it also includes psychiatric outpatient services in that process. So it's 12,000 individuals over a given year that are provided. A core of those are held with DCT 24/7 for secure treatment.
Okay. Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much. So a follow-up question is, of your $736 million budget. What's the fastest growing part of your budget? Thanks, Chair.
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, representatives, the fastest growing aspect for us today is really around staffing. Of our operational budget that's coming forward, 85% of that is for past COLA increases. It is also for step increases. It's also for all the additional FMLA, the additional different budget and employment aspects that are done with that. And that's really what our largest piece moving forward will be. In a 24/7 operation, you can imagine, like casinos, nobody goes home. We always have to have people on staff. As Carrie mentioned earlier, one of our biggest aspects is staffing. And we've really struggled getting staffing, as all hospitals are trying to fill all their vacancies at this time. As a result of that piece of, that we're not having full staffing, we asked individuals to volunteer for overtime. But because we're a secure environment, if we don't get volunteers, and this happens like a lot on the night shifts, we do get forced overtime to move forward. Those are all costs related to employment that we've got to address to ensure that our staff and our patients and clients are safe in, at the organization.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much for that overview. And I'd like to just say thanks to all the staff that do care for those that are there right now. I imagine the load is heavy, and I don't believe they probably get recognized for what they're doing. So thanks to their to your staff, to our staff that are taking care of folks. So my last question I have then in regards to staffing being the biggest concern, and also the people that come in as staff to take care of people that are struggling, and some are in really in a bad way in their life's journey. And so I would just be concerned. I'm just really concerned about paid family medical leave rolling out. And curious if your executive board, are you looking at things on how that's going to look? Again, you can't leave people unattended. And if people are going to be, you know, out for 12 weeks plus an additional 8 weeks, up to 20 weeks out, how are you going to find staff that are qualified to take care of folks that are in your hospital situations?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, and all members, that is a challenge that we are looking and already been dealing with the old FMLA. As the new laws went into effect, we're seeing how that's going to affect DCT and how we're going to manage that is really centrally right now. Identify where in our divisions it's going to be impacting the most, because today's changes allows individuals to say, hey, I can't come in this morning because of FMLA. Well, a last-minute change for a direct care and treatment is really difficult for us to find somebody to fill behind that person. So it does fall on the existing staff for a lot of that. If there are people that are willing to do a double shift or that they're willing to volunteer for that overtime, that's where we want to be in working with the unions to make that happen as best as possible. But that's our challenge. And we've got some resources to make sure that we're covered as far as the cost related to that. But I know we got to work with the unions on how best to manage this. We don't know if this is a breadbasket or if it's going to be a Volvo. How big is this in the process that we've got to figure out? So we've got some funding in our central office budget operating request that would allow us to manage those aspects.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is to Mr. Storkamp. Talking about all of the staff, the thousands of staff, are they all responsible for their own safety? And if they are, do you still have a safety officer at these facilities?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frederick. Yes, safety is one of our top priority, as well as the quality of care. And we do have safety officers that will continue at the sites. Nothing that is going to change around that just because they're going to be becoming our own agency. I would say that we need to provide as much training as we can to employees about safety as well as options when they're put in difficult situations. We are challenged at direct care and treatment that we have individuals that have come from corrections. We've got individuals that have come from jails. So they don't change tendencies just because they move facilities or move sites. And we've got to ensure that we've got the best training possible that's out there. Always improvements that could be done in that area, but there's an awful lot of required training for DCT staff to ensure that they get a lot of that. In a non-direct contact, I put on about 29 different trainings a year, just because I do walk-in facilities from time to time, and our staff have a lot more of that at the facilities, because we want them to have muscle memory. We want them to be able to handle a situation that is difficult in that process.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then my follow-up question is, or what I heard from your answer is, everyone in the situation that they find themselves in are responsible for their own piece, whatever that is, whether that's direct care or not, and that they do their specific job. But there's still a safety officer who is ultimately responsible for the safety of the individual facilities. That person, I mean, we're talking about accountability. And I think that that's important, right? Because that person that's accountable, if there is a system-wide failure, you have that person to go to say, hey, you just had 100 staff get injured because there's not adequate safety procedures in place. You know who to go to. And if that's, we know, is a tried and true method, that accountability is a good thing. My question then comes into this executive board. I can appreciate having members of the executive board who serve at staggered periods of time to have that continuity of an organization. And I think that can be a good thing. Where my question comes into play, though, is that if we know we need somebody who is centrally accountable, who is that person on the executive board? If we as a legislature want oversight of this, yes, there is the advisory board where we can, where we'll have some membership there. But if we as a committee wanted to hold someone accountable for a failure or a success within direct care and treatment, who's that person?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frederickson. Direct care and treatment has a chief executive officer. The CEO is responsible for the day-to-day operation of our organization. That is the person who's held accountable, and the board is holding that person accountable for the day-to-day actions. So the board's delegating that operation to that individual, and that person would then be held accountable for actions of DCT overall. And in the legislation that we passed last year, it actually allowed the governor's office to question any of the executive or CEO of their organization, and the board would have to do an investigation on that individual, and then the governor has an option of putting somebody on the board for voting on disciplinary actions around that. So it really would be centered around our CEO, which is exactly how we're coordinating today, is our CEO is the one that is responsible for it. Under the commission model, he reports up to the commissioner. Under board model, that same individual is going to report up to the board.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we could find ourselves in a situation where the CEO we don't agree with, we think that person, whoever it is not doing a sufficient job or does something that's egregious. But we would not have the ability, nor from what you're saying, even the governor wouldn't have the ability to remove an individual who is failing at their job. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederick, I would say that we are still under state government, and if there are outrageous things that are occurring with that, that individual would be addressed for their actions in that process. I think what you're asking specifically is about the governor being able to fire somebody. I think that's what you're asking about, and that is not what is currently set up under law. It would be the board that would be firing the CEO for actions taken on that.
Hmm. Representative Frederick?
So, Mr. Chair, I think that we just outlined a space that this committee could look at this year and potential changes to the board to ensure accountability is happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Stockham, is the CEO, does the CEO need to be confirmed by the Senate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Knorr, that is correct. The Senate does have to confirm, as well as the Senate has confirmed the executive board like all other boards that are in statute.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is more in line. The CEO acts as a cabinet level individual who sits in the cabinet position. Is that correct?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Knorr, I understand that
I haven't reached Senator level. That's a demotion.
Sorry for giving that promotion.
Demotion, actually.
It's not demotion. The Commissioner, sorry, distractions here. The Commissioner, I apologize. Can you repeat the question?
Representative Ford.
So we're talking about the CEO and also the board being appointed at the same time. The CEO will be a cabinet level position whereby they sit at the table and advise and sit with the executive agency.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr.
Director Starkin.
The understanding I have about this is they will not be a cabinet level individual, but they are a state agency, so they'll be sitting with the state agencies. Not every state agency is at that cabinet level.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this similar to what we have in Minshew? Because we also have a CEO in Minshew since we created.
Director Starkin.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr here. The answer is yes.
Representative Knorr.
So, Mr. Chair, I think there is a complete process when it comes to accountability and ensuring that the board, because we just created, they haven't even taken the initiative. So I think we need to look into what did we pass and where the gaps are in the legislative process, because it has not yet come to fruition. It's not yet functional. So I'm hoping that we can, Representative Frederick and I and others who are interested, look into that model and figure out what is missing, so we can have a more comprehensive board functioning, because you're competing with the other hospitals, and the hospitals are run by a board. And the boards can make quick decisions. They're responsible for the operations of those hospitals. So we model this from how other major hospitals are being run. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Final question for this segment, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Director Starkman, appreciate you being here. Appreciate the work that happens over DCT and all the staff that's working out there. The questions I have are a little bit more toward the staffing and vacancies. We know we've got quite a issue in the behavioral health world because there just is not the capacity out there. And it's something that happens at all levels. I know that part of the problems of the capacity is that we don't have every level built out. And some of the people that you are treating don't always have somewhere to go. And at the same time, we don't have necessarily capacity in the system for everyone who needs the intense services that is provided by the state. So some of the questions I have is that right now, how many open beds do you have that we could have somebody in because we aren't able to get the staff out there? And why are the reasons we aren't able to hire the staff out there?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, and members, the direct care and treatment is operating at a 93% level right now. It is where we feel that we can manage it within the current budget, in the current process. So we don't have, quote, vacant beds or vacant areas at this time that could be brought on in many of our areas. There's always a bed or two here that needs to be upgraded or a toilet that doesn't work in the process. So those are kind of part of that piece. But we are operating at 93% level across the board. I think it's even higher at Anoka, like 96% in that area. Clearly, the system does not have enough resources, as you've talked about. And our CEO, Marshall Smith, talks about a 12-inch ruler and says, think of this as the mental health system. On one end is really the getting into the system is very, at the very beginning. The other is number 12, which is direct care and treatment. We are the 12 that needs to do this. We've got people in 12 that really need 8 through 11 in the community, but there's just no places in the community for them to go. same thing the other way around, is that they've got individuals that need to come into our service, and we don't have enough beds in the process. If you are talking about a relook at the mental health system, we don't have a system. We've got a lot of things that were just built over time. Realize DC&T started back in the 1800s with the first asylum, as they called it, back in 1960 or 1965, or 1865 in that process. We've had up to 5,000, 7,000 people in that area at one time. We've then, this body decided to reduce the numbers and say that we need to deinstitutionalize individuals. But today we do have a very limited number of resources at the number 12. But I gotta say, we also need resources in the community, in rural areas as well as urban areas, to address that.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. And, you know, as we're talking about the capacity out there, you know, one of the things I know that is right now, a lot of kiddos get sent out of state because we don't have capacity here. And from what I recall, I see that we've got one facility in Kandy, Ohio, targeted toward kids that have got, you know, from what I understand, capability of 16 beds. What would it take to bring more on? And are there any proposals, you know, if there are resources needed, are there any proposals coming forward to address that part?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, as well as the members, juveniles are also an area that resources are needed. There's about 100 individuals that aren't getting treatment today that either get out of state or are dealing with other aspects in the community that need some aspect. I can't say all 100 individuals need to come direct care and treatment. Again, we have a continuum of individuals here that need to be addressed in that process. And what we've been talking about is looking at options for both juveniles and adults moving forward. We've got one facility, as you mentioned, our CABS facility, that is a 16-bed juvenile facility, and we could possibly add another one if resources are obtained, as well as we've got a 50-bed facility that this body gave us pre-design funding for at our NOCA facility that would be shovel-ready if we wanted to move forward. The governor's office did not put any of those proposals in the budget this year. Part of it is we got the priority admission, and I'm guessing at some point you'll want the priority admission group to come talk to you about what they're finding and the direction that they're going. But their report just came out after the budget came out, and I know the governor's office and others are looking at that aspect. One key point for this group on budget and resources, it takes a lot to build a facility, but within 3 years your operating budget will surpass that. So don't forget that if you build it, you've also got to provide the staffing and the dollars to support it.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, Director Starkman. This helps gives an idea of what we're going to be looking at going forward. So while this is an area that has a large dollar amount, if we're going to take care of the citizens in our state who need it, we're going to have to make that investment. And part of this I'm tying back is we're always hearing about the boarding problem in the hospitals, and part of that is our responsibility. And we've got a capacity issue, and I know in some areas of the state they're looking at building out different parts of the system, and it's critical that we continue that. One of the other issues I wonder is, you mentioned there were some things that didn't make it into the governor's budget. One of the questions I have is, I know last year it was proposed to close CARES up in Carlton, and I know that we're keeping it on. I do know that's an older facility. What is the capacity happening up there right now? Is that a facility that is going to need investment in? Do we need to have something happening that's replacing it? What is happening with CARES Carlton?
Director Stark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, I will give you $10 afterwards for that question. Thank you very much. This body actually asked us to come up with options around chemical dependency and what we've got out there. We've got a report that will be coming out that will give you options, everything from consolidation all the way up to keeping or even creating new facilities. Talks about the facilities that are in good condition and those facilities that aren't in good condition. And so we'd be happy to come talk about that once that report's out.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So I was asking about CARES Carlton. I appreciate we do have the bigger problem out there. Does that mean that's going to be addressed in the report that's coming out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, that is correct.
Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you. I'll look forward to the report. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Director Starkin, for taking our questions there. Director Kaling, welcome to the committee. Yeah, I'm sure you're settled in by now. If you could please identify yourself for the record and continue with the presentation.
Sure. I'm Greg Paling, the Chief Business Technology Officer, partnering with Direct Care and Treatment. So I'm a Minute employee.
Great. Let's move to the next slide. Our goal was really to get out of paper. We had boxes and boxes of paper that we needed to move into electronic processes. And in doing so, we've worked with Minute as well as our vendor to come up with a three-phase approach. One is looking at the core essential needs of an EHR system from admission to discharge. Second is really looking at more of the revenue and all the wraparound services that go along with that core record. And then third is really the interoperability and being able to exchange information with other healthcare organizations as well as connect our systems to others in the state so we can provide better information on the whole system as opposed to CT has in that process. Phase one was a pretty significant process for us. We went through a two-year planning process with our vendor, Minute, and DCT to identify what needs to change. We had a lot of input from all of our staff and all of our sites and all of our programs and moving forward. This partnership carried forward into the phase one. We spent 2 years planning with hundreds of people. We had 50 super users spending a day a week identifying workflows and processes and new ways of doing business as well as consistency across all our sites. We've got 37 new workflows, 129 new processes, 8 new modules that we were able to add, 3 majorly enhanced modules, and those modules are listed on the right side of the chart here, 2,600 users, and with Minute and Greg's help, we were able to get all that implemented on one day. And we went live July 16th. July 17th is when blue screen took effect. And because we had a process in place for addressing what we were doing, it was perfect timing for us. It was a bad situation. But know that we had an incident command set up at different levels. We had the executives from our electronic health record vendor. We had Greg and myself, as well as some of our key people meeting almost 24/7 for the first few days and had that going for several weeks. We had another layer down that talked about the operations and fixing with those three organizations, as well as each site had a incident command for our staff in that process. So you're going to ask, well, how and why were we so successful in that process? On the next slide, first of all, this is the 37 workflows. Just to give you a sense, we're not talking about a little change here, a little change there. This is talking about labs, engagement, orders, both on the medical side as well as the operational side in that process. What made us successful is working with our staff in the process. We started in February, well before July, on, hey, this is coming down the pike. We had videos from our executive and our executive director, talking about what is changing, how is it going to change. We had some trainings that were early on about the 101s, if you will. We then added the 201s, or 200 level classes, that got into that, okay, now this is my job and I need to do these type of things. Now know that many of our staff, like nurses and some of our direct care staff, are in the EHR on a regular basis. So we felt that we had to give them additional training in that process. But it wasn't just about the process. When we went live, we put a lot of user support together. Not only talked about the incident command team, but we've had specialized training. We had 24/7 support from our vendor for the first 2 months. We had sandboxes that our users could actually go in and see how it's done. We had office hours so they could come in and ask questions about how is this going to affect me personally in the process. When we went go live, we had people at all levels from Minute to DCT to Minute to our vendor, and people on the ground actually at the sites from our vendor and Minute and DCT to help our staff understand what that first day is. The process. Greg, is there anything that you'd add to that day in that process?
No, I think you handled it just fine.
Kaylin. Director Stark.
Mr. Chair. Next slide. We were very honored that the governor gave us a finalist for electronic health record when he put out his One Minnesota Implementation Awards. While we didn't win it, we were very excited that we were one out of 76 that applied that were really down to the finalist process. Next slide. This is the actual application and some of the key people that were involved in that. Next slide. So where do we go from here? We're in phase two and phase three right now. We've got 12 different projects that are actually moving forward at this time. As you can see, everything from revenue capture all the way through new dietary system. We've got a new dental system that's being implemented. Our community-based services is going to put in tracking mechanisms to allow us to understand and to be able to bill in that process. We talked about interoperability. We actually got over, we got several hundred continuity care documents from other healthcare systems that are already being entered into our system, but we're enhancing that process and adding more each day, as well as the interoperability for our e-labs for both orders and coming back. One of the key pieces in the future is we're actually partnering with NetSmart and AWS on looking at how do we connect data. They call them data lakes in the process. So we're actually beginning to talk with the courts, seeing if we can get civil commitment information electronically. We're talking about getting other information around our clients and specifically like encounter data that would allow us to say, who's actually coming in the system? What are they coming in with? Where are they going to? And what type of programming and treatment modalities are actually being effective in that process? It is a huge goal to get to that information. But if we get that, it provides policymakers with a lot more information as well as we kind of move forward. So with that, we'd stand for questions on our electronic health record or any other area.
Thank you, Director Starkin, for that piece, and to all of you for the presentation that we've had today. Are there questions for the Director, Representative Gander?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look through these 12 items, I don't see anything about eye care. I'm sure you're aware that uncorrected refractive error or untreated eye disease can really affect really how agitated we are and how we function in life. Have you built that in here somewhere? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gander. Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Gander. I would say that all of those activities are taken care of in the facilities, not necessarily by in-house, but we do a lot with the outside providers. So what we've done here is the continuity care documents are actually what comes back to tell us what's occurred at hospital visits or at office visits, taking care of eye issues, or hearing issues or anything else that our clients need in that process.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Starkin, I'm just wondering, on the phase two piece, there's the revenue capture management piece of what you're doing. Is there revenue outside of the Department of Human Services or the counties that you receive?
Mr. Chair and representatives, direct care and treatment gets an allocation for most of our programs from this body. If we do and we're able to bill, that goes back to the general fund. So we bill as much as we can to make sure that the general fund, but we wouldn't be able to operate our facilities without having that direct appropriation in the process. But as we're looking at this, we are looking at all ways that we can bill more, Medicare, Medicaid, or other aspect to actually help the state in that process.
Okay, so this is more of a forward-looking type of what we can do with what we have for a structure moving forward, Director?
Mr. Chair, yours, yes. It is really looking at how can we change our business processes to collect more information, or collect more, or don't allow requests to expire within a time frame set by the federal government. This allows us to actually bring in a few more revenues than previously anticipated, and we're looking at other options to see if we can bring in more.
Thank you, Director. We'll look at banking those in the next budget. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're talking about technology, electronic health records. I think there's a good reason to do that because of where DCT was and where we wanted them to go. You know, the old system was not great system. Let me put it that way. It's because of effectiveness and efficiency that we were able to get the electronic health record. And some of the other challenges, I think Director Greg and I, we've worked in disaster recovery for the state. So are you prepared in terms of when you're doing disaster recovery for the new system that you have so far?
Director Palin.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr. Short answer is yes, and it's kind of fitting that you just asked that question. We're in the process now with our EHR vendor, who is NetSmart, our strategic partner. We're they as part of the contract, they do disaster recovery once a year, at least once a year to recover it. We're in the process of just planning out a tabletop exercise with them to make sure that we can fully recover the system if it were to go down. So yes, we do that.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I think we also had some challenges with my avatar, you know, the integration modules for that. How are we doing so far in terms of making sure that system is communicating well with the new electronic health record system?
Mr. Chair and Representative Knorr, yes, we've had our challenges over the years with that, but we've much improved the digital experience for the people that serve the patients and the residents of direct care and treatment. And what we've done is a couple of things. We've improved our firewalls and our networks on the network on our end. And then on NetSmart is right now currently in their own government cloud, but we're moving to the AWS cloud here in March, which will also help improve that experience. Sometimes you can hear bits and pieces throughout the state with 200 different locations. Depending on the internet access in a certain place within the state, it might be a little different experience, but overall there's been much improvement and there's been very, very little downtime over the past year.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the level of staff satisfaction or feedback on the new system, because we're moving away more from paper to electronic system?
Mr. Chair,
Starkin.
Representative Knorr. I would say that we're actually, let me back up. We have a chief medical informatics officer and a chief nursing informatics officer that is responsible for identifying all aspects of how we move forward with our electronic health record in a medical environment. They've actually put together a process to evaluate user satisfaction. We did our baseline before we went live, and we are waiting for a few more months for people to get acclimated with the system, but we'll be then tracking that. Is it the USPQ something in that process? It's a nationally known process for evaluating a user experience that we've implemented to ensure that we've done that. We've also are working with our vendor to ensure that people are using the system as we're anticipated and looking for dashboards that will help us identify that.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Closing on the technology piece, we're not right now any revenue coming in. It just goes to the general fund. And so in order to maintain the system we're building right now, we need to build that infrastructure in the long term. So I think we need to find a continuous revenue, as you noted, Mr. Chair, in, when it comes to the technology that we invested right now to make sure that we don't come back after 10 years and say the system is not functioning because we never anticipated building an ongoing support. I don't know if any one of you wanted to comment on that.
Mr. Chair, members, I would just say that we greatly appreciate the $48 million that you gave us 2 years ago. That carried us through fiscal year 24, 25, and 26, 27. As Representative Knorr mentioned, it's the out years that become the issue. Adding 8 new modules, enhancing 3, creates a licensing issue as we kind of move forward that needs to be addressed on an annual basis as we move forward. And a system is not all of a sudden done one day. There are constant changes. You have to curb new regulations, new requirements, new laws in that process that we've got to incorporate into our processes. So we do need ongoing funding in the future. I would say that with the funding that we got and with what we held our vendor accountable for, with how we contracted with them, and that's something Greg and I have worked real closely with them on, we've got some reductions that help carry us through the next fiscal year with the funding. It'll be after that that we're going to reevaluate the need.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now going back to DCT, we temporarily stopped the 48-hour rule, meaning that until medically necessary beds are available. How are we doing with that transition? Do we have enough beds, and do we have enough resources to be able to accomplish that task?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr and members, the medically necessary language was put in for a two-year period, which expires June 30th of this year. The intent here was the 48-hour rule was not, we didn't have the resources that are available for accomplishing what the original intent of the 48-hour rule was, which was within 48 hours have people come from jails when requiring the treatment and direct care and treatment in the process. We just don't have those resources available to us today, and it didn't allow for other admissions from hospitals or so forth to come into the system. You allowed 10 to jump the list, if you will. You added this medically appropriate bed, so it's really tied to the modality treatment that's needed by the patients and their diagnosis in that process. The priority admission task force that you'll hear from talks about extending that for 2 years. Again, we've only had a 12-month or even less time frame to evaluate where and how it, well it's working in the process. We're recommending that it also to just give that medically necessary appropriate for another 2 years so we can then come back and tell you how it's working and the direction we're going in that process. Realize you can't get it right on the first day, and therefore we're making tweaks every day in that process and working with the task force as we kind of move forward.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You noted people are coming directly from jail, but you also get individuals from the hospitals. I know last year we increased a specific request for 10 individuals to be moved from the hospitals. Are you still seeing that pipeline for folks who are being discharged or who are lingering hospitals sent to direct care and treatment?
Director Starkin.
Chair and members, we are
Director Brunis.
Sorry, Chair and members, we are still seeing that pipeline, and you will see that the priority admissions review panel actually has a recommendation to continue the hospital exception in the report.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chan. Also, finally, if individuals do not meet what you call the medical DNMC, we use a lot of acronyms here, sorry about that. The patient does not meet medical qualification to be within DCT. What happens to the process? I know last year we paid for the counties, so the counties were not paying into that funding, which is going to expire by June. What is the process going forward with individuals who are DNMC?
Director Briones.
Chair and Representative Knorr, if I'm understanding your question, when that language would expire, it would revert back to the prior process where the counties would then be responsible for that 100% of that amount if patients are DNMC.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason why I bring that up is because I think most of the counties who came to present here say that they're being charged more resources when it comes to their share. You know, the amount that they're going to be paying for the services that DCT is providing. What is the plan to address that challenge for the counties?
Tarkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, representatives, the direct care and treatments continue to work with our partners, counties, as well as the priority admission task force to look at all the best options moving forward. We've got about 30% of individuals at our ANOCA site that do not meet criteria at this time, and that would be the county responsibility moving forward. If there were placements in the community that we could move those individuals to, that would help free up psychiatric beds so we could bring in more people into that process. As I mentioned, it's a come in and come out process here that we got to look at as we kind of move forward, and we got to look at the whole system and how we make that happen.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's more discussion on this whole process of DCT. We'll wait for once we have bills before us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knorr. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question regarding the map that was in our packet. You guys maybe want to look at the map. So when we look at the northwest corner of the state and the southwest corner of the state, if I'm looking at this right, it really doesn't look like we have many locations. And so I want to know, like, I don't want the data and I don't want the acronyms. I want the story of Greater Minnesota. So tell me what happens in our communities when we have members that live and thrive in our communities but need these services and supports. What I think happens and what we hear happens is, one, when a Greater Minnesota individual needs supports in the metro, they're just told no, or we're getting complacent in just being okay with sending our Minnesotan residents over to another state for services. So I'm interested from your, any one of your perspectives, what is the Greater Minnesota story here, and how are we making sure that individuals who live in the northwest, southwest corners of our state are able to get the services and supports that they need within our own communities?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, the direct care and treatment in our hospital system, which is our community-based hospitals, are scattered throughout the state, north, south. They will take individuals from all aspects or from all regions of the state. Same thing with our chemical addiction, or CD efforts. Again, the resource issue comes to play is there's not enough resources. We do not designate based on regional. We base more on treatment need of the individual, and we've got a central pre-admission that actually is the source or the group that talks about where a bed's available and the need of the individual, where they match that up. And a lot of times it's not in the region that you're talking about because we don't have enough of those type of beds in every region. So we've got individuals from all locations at several of our sites from around the state.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Can you elaborate a little bit when you say resources? What does that mean?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, I'm actually talking about beds and the availability of getting somebody in one of our facilities.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. So resources, is that you need more professional staff? Like, you just need physical beds. I'm guessing you need more than physical beds. You need probably professional staff, individuals in the community that are highly trained, have different licensing capacities. And so I guess I'm leaning into more of that question. I know we need more beds. You've said that. But can you break down what sort of resources it is that you need? And then I guess I'm leaning into, similar to other areas, if we don't have the professional capacity in Greater Minnesota, how are you moving forward, working with partnering with our higher education institutions to make sure that we have the professionals to do this in our communities?
Director Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler and members, direct care and treatment is a little in the forefront trying to get psychiatrists in. We've got a fellowship program that we're working on, so people actually come in and get trained by our psychiatrists and others to help in that process. You're absolutely right that if we added 50 beds somewhere in the state, we would need a lot of professional resources to help in that process. We would be happy to have Dr. Stevens, our medical executive director, come in and talk about what they've put in place to help with this. But even that's small in the need that's out there. This isn't just a DCT issue, as you know. It's hospitals around the state and treatment programs that are needing this level of individuals that just aren't available and even more scarce in rural Minnesota.
Representative Keeler.
I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Question I have goes back to the civil commitment. If I was hearing right, you were talking about that in the electronic records system, that you've got a component that is going to do a better job of, I understood, getting the information on civil commitments. Could you tell me a little bit more about that, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, let me back up about 14 years ago. The Supreme Court, every time that they gave a civil commitment, gave DCT a packet of like this with paper. And that paper went over to DCT, where we actually entered it on 3x5 cards in that process. Since that time, the court has a new electronic system for tracking all of those things. We've got access into viewing that information, but we're working with the courts to see if we can actually get that electronically so that we can then do some more analysis on that data, as well as look more at what options and what's working with our clients.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, Director, for that information. I appreciate that you're working in that direction, and the reason I'm raising it is that one of the things I have seen, I've heard from some of our local judges in Ramsey County here, is that person will be civilly committed, and then they eventually get lost in the system because there's no way to track it, where somebody who might get civilly committed here in Ramsey County, if that person is not at the level of acuity of needing to be housed in the hospital, may end up in a very unstable situation, may float to other parts of the state. They will show up elsewhere in the state and start entering the process, but because of the way the tracking is right now, that information does not follow that person, so they could be end up in another part of the state and be treated for something else and then released again. Where this causes a problem is, number one, we're losing the people, they're not getting the services that they need. Number two, another part of the problem that I learned from the judge I was talking to is that after 6 months, if the original case manager can't find the person and has lost contact, that person is now deemed as being competent, even though they may still meet all the criteria for being civilly committed. There's a hole in the system. I'm currently working on a bill. I've approached Representative Baker on this. I know the Senate is working on a bill to try to get more information better coordinated in this area. And I think this is one of the issues that we have is we've got such a fractured system that where we need to have things stitched together, it's not happening. I appreciate hearing that DCT is looking at trying to do that because that could help give us a central warehouse where we can start finding that information in a digital way. And I would really encourage to continue working that. And I'd like to follow up with you offline also.
Any follow-up to that, Director Starkin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher would be happy to work with you on that piece. I think just so the committee understands what Representative Fisher is talking about is the courts don't necessarily send all civil commitments to DCT. They civil commit them, but they put them right on provisional discharge. And that process is not monitored. It's more locally driven in that process. And that's something I think we all need to look at as we kind of move forward. So thank you for raising that.
Thank you, Director. Ed, anything else, Representative Fisher? Representative Bonnie Hiltzley.
Thank you. You did very well. Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much, Director, and your team for being here. So we have Dr. Gander on the other side. I don't have the privilege of that title, but what I do have is background in data privacy and data protection. And then so going back to Representative Fisher's question in lines to the electronic health system and around individual data privacy, execution of individual data rights. I'm wondering what's the current process that your department is executing at the moment, and does the transition to the new system change that process? Just curious to know. Thank you.
Mr. Starkin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say that data privacy is the top priority for us around data. As we kind of move forward, we've got a data practices official that is in DHS. We are hiring a DCT specific one, so we will have an individual that will be responsible for that moving forward. We have to understand that our data goes into more security than just what data practices has because we have chemical dependency data, and that's at a whole different level that we've got to monitor and manage as we move forward. Working with AWS to develop these data lakes so we understand what data we've got, who has access to it, and all the security and data criteria around what goes in those processes to help understand when we can give out the data and when we can't in that process. And then we'll have a data manager that will be looking at this overall to make sure that the right people are getting the right information. All data requests come to us, and our legal team is the one that's reviewing it with the data practices on what we can give out and where. And that goes beyond just private, it's also when somebody comes in about civil commitments and what can we get from the courts, where can we go with many of these things. So they've been integral in our conversations.
Representative Omani Hiltzley.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Director.
All right, any further questions for the directors today? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your time today. And with no further business, we are adjourned until 8:15 tomorrow morning.
Thank you, members.